So, I want you to imagine, if you will, a god.
Okay.
But I don't mean the kind the kind you might be used to hearing about on a Sunday morning. I want you to picture a being that is absolutely perfect, completely eternal, and is essentially the ultimate reason the entire universe moves and exists.
Right, the big boss.
Exactly. But here is the massive catch. This god has absolutely no idea that you exist.
Yeah, and actually, it goes even further than that. This god has no idea the universe exists at all.
It's just such a wild concept to wrap your head
It
around.
really is.
So we are doing a deep dive today into some incredibly mind-bending stuff. We're looking at Dr. Arthur Holmes's lecture, A History of Philosophy, Aristotle's God. We're going to be exploring Book 12 of Aristotle's Metaphysics and then taking a bit of a sharp turn into his toolkit for thinking, which is the Organon.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating here is that we aren't looking at theology born from, religious revelation or faith.
Right, no burning bushes.
Exactly. No tablets coming down from the mountain. This is what we call natural theology.
Okay, for the listener who might be new to that term, what exactly does that mean?
It means it's a concept of God constructed entirely out of cold, hard physics and rigorous logic. It's basically an engineering problem.
An engineering problem.
Yeah, Aristotle basically looks up at the stars and says, well, something has to be spinning these things. And he eventually lands on this specific type of deity as the only logical solution.
But the personality of this deity, I mean, if you can even call it a personality, is just so aloof. It's almost narcissistic.
It is the ultimate exercise in logic over emotion, without a doubt.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand this god, we have to understand the universe that Aristotle was actually looking at. He obviously didn't have a telescope, but he had a system.
A very strict system.
Right. He had this framework called the four causes, and I feel like before we even get to the cosmos, we really need to understand that framework because he applies it to literally everything, right?
He does. For Aristotle, if you want to completely explain
To nothing at all.
anything, a chair, a statue, a planet, you have to answer four specific questions about it: the material cause, the efficient cause, the formal cause, and the final cause.
Okay, let's try this out. I'm actually holding a ceramic coffee mug right now, so walk me through the Aristotelian, the why of this mug.
All right, let's do it. First, the material cause. That one is simple. What is it made of?
Ceramic, you know, clay.
Right. Second is the efficient cause. This is the force that actually brought it into being, the thing that pushed the clay.
Okay, so that would be the potter, or I guess the machine in the factory that stamped it out.
Exactly. That's the efficient cause. It's the source of motion. Third is the formal cause. Think of this as the blueprint. What makes it a mug and not just a weird lump of clay?
The shape, the handle, the fact that it's a cylinder, the definition of mugness.
Precisely. Mugness. And finally, the final cause,
Yeah.
the telos. What is its purpose? Like, why was it made in the first place?
To hold my coffee so I can actually stay awake for this deep dive.
And there you have it. You have now fully explained the mug according to Aristotle. Now,
Right.
he takes that exact same framework and applies it to the entire universe.
That is a massive jump from a coffee mug to the whole cosmos.
It is, but he was incredibly systematic. So picture the Aristotelian universe. It is not like our modern view at all.
Right.
You have the Earth totally stationary right in the center. Around it, you have these planets moving in circles. And then at the very edge of everything, the outer perimeter, you have what he called the fixed stars.
And these stars aren't just sitting there, they're spinning.
Endlessly, they're rotating on their axes in a perfect eternal circle. And this creates a huge physics problem for Aristotle.
Why?
Because in Greek physics, motion isn't the default state.
Wait, explain that, because today, we have inertia. If I throw a baseball in deep space, it just keeps going forever until something stops it.
Right, but that's Newton.
Yeah.
Aristotle didn't know about inertia. For him, the natural state of an object is at rest. Yeah, if something is moving, something else must be actively moving it right now. If the pusher stops pushing, the mover stops moving.
Wow. Okay, so his universe doesn't have cruise control.
Exactly, no cruise control.
No.
So look at those fixed stars. They are massive celestial spheres, and they are spinning. So using that efficient cause we just talked about, Aristotle asks, what is pushing them?
Okay, so it's like a chain reaction. The fixed stars move the layer of ether below them, which moves the planets, which eventually messes with our atmosphere down here. But the big question is, who or what is spinning those fixed stars at the very edge?
Precisely. If the fixed stars are moving, there has to be a cause. Let's just call it cause X.
Okay.
But if cause X is also moving in order to push the stars, then it needs a cause. And if that cause is moving, it needs a cause.
And you just end up with an infinite regression. It's just turtles all the way down.
And Aristotle absolutely hates infinite regressions. He says logic demands that the buck has to stop somewhere. There must be a first link in that chain.
So logically, he just concludes there must be something just outside the perimeter of the universe, something that causes motion, but, and I think this is the crucial part, does not move itself. The unmoved mover.
The unmoved mover.
I mean, it sounds like a comic book villain name.
It does.
But it is actually the cornerstone of his entire worldview. But here is where I get stuck. If this thing doesn't move, how does it even exist? Dr. Holmes talks about this concept of pure actuality. What does that even mean?
This is a heavy concept, but it is totally essential to get Aristotle's God. Think about how we change. If I walk across the room or if I decide to learn to play the guitar, I am actualizing a potential.
Okay, so before I learn guitar, I am potentially a guitar player. After I learn, I am actually a guitar player.
Exactly. Change is just the process of turning potential into reality. Mm. But think about what that actually implies. It implies you weren't finished yet.
Right.
It implies you lack something. You lack the skill of guitar playing, so you had to change to get it.
So change implies a lack. It inherently implies imperfection.
Right. Now apply that logic to the first cause. If the unmoved mover changed, if it moved or learned or grew, it would imply that it had some unfulfilled potential before that change. It would imply it wasn't perfect yet.
Oh, I see. So to be the ultimate cause, it has to be completely finished. No potential left at all. Just 100% realized.
Correct. It was pure actuality. It cannot change for the better because it is already perfect. It cannot change for the worse because then it wouldn't be the perfect cause anymore. It is frozen in a state of absolute perfection.
Which brings us to the big twist, and I really think this is the part that trips people up.
Yeah.
If this God is frozen in perfection, and it cannot move, because moving would be a change,
right?
How on earth does it spin the stars?
It is the central paradox of the whole system.
I mean, seriously, if I want to move a couch, I have to push it. I have to exert physical force. But Aristotle says God cannot exert force.
No, he can't. Because if God exerts force, he is changing from not pushing to pushing. He is expending energy. He's doing work. That completely violates pure actuality. So God is not an efficient cause. He is not a mechanic cranking an engine.
So if he doesn't push, how do the stars move?
He acts as a final cause.
A goal.
A goal. The unmoved mover moves the universe not by pushing it, but by attracting it, by being the ultimate object of desire.
That is surprisingly poetic for a cold logic puzzle.
It is, isn't it? The analogy often used here is that of a lover. Imagine you walk into a crowded party.
Okay.
And across the room, you see the person you are just deeply in love with. Maybe it's a celebrity or just a massive crush. They are just standing there. They aren't pushing you. They aren't dragging you. They might not even know you are there.
But I move toward them.
Exactly. You move because of them. Their mere existence causes you to move. They are the final cause of your motion.
Wow. So the fixed stars, these giant celestial spheres up in space, are essentially in love with God.
In a manner of speaking, yes. Aristotle believes the universe is besouled, or alive in some way. The stars, or the souls of the stars, see the perfection of the unmoved mover, and they desire that perfection. They just want to be like it.
But they can't be like it, right? Because they are made of matter, and God is pure reality.
They can never be fully still and perfect like God is. So the best they can do is imitate perfection through the most perfect motion possible. And for the ancient Greeks, the most perfect eternal motion is the circle.
No beginning, no end.
Exactly. So they spin. They spin out of a sheer desire to imitate God.
That is wild. It's romantic, but also kind of tragic. They are chasing a perfection they can literally never catch.
Yeah, Dr. Holmes mentions the daffodil analogy here, which I think really helps if you want to take the conscious romance out of it a little bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think of a daffodil bulb buried down in the dirt. Yeah. It doesn't have a brain. It doesn't know it wants to be a flower.
It's not sitting there thinking, you know, I'd look great in yellow this spring.
Right. But it has a nature, a drive within it to actualize its potential and become a daffodil. It strives for its form completely unconsciously. Aristotle suggests the cosmos has this same intrinsic striving toward the unmoved mover. It's just a natural attraction.
Okay, so we have this universe that has always existed because Aristotle says matter is eternal, right? This God didn't create the stuff.
Correct. That is a huge distinction from the Judeo-Christian view or the Islamic view. Aristotle's God is not a creator. The matter was always there. God is really just the battery that keeps it spinning by being beautiful.
So the universe is looking at God, spinning away, but what is God doing? Because if he is pure actuality, he has to be active. You can't be actively perfect by just doing nothing.
This is where we get to the nature of God's mind. Aristotle asks, what is the highest, most perfect activity possible?
And being a philosopher, he probably thinks the answer is thinking.
Naturally. Thinking, or contemplation, is the absolute highest activity, so God must be thinking. But then the tricky question arises, what does God think about?
Does he think about the stars? Does he think about the sparrow falling? Does he think about me?
And the answer is a resounding no.
Ouch. That stings a little. Why not?
Think about it logically. If God thought about you, or the stars, or that sparrow, his thoughts would be determined by something outside of himself. He would be moved by an external object.
Oh, I see. If I do something stupid, God would have to think, oh, look, he did something stupid. I would effectively be changing God's mind.
Exactly. Mm. And that introduces potentiality and change into God. That breaks the whole system. Also, Aristotle argues that a perfect being should only think about the most perfect object. It would actually be beneath his dignity to think about imperfect things like us. It would be like a genius mathematician spending eternity just thinking about 2 plus 2 equals 4.
So there is only one thing perfect enough for God to think about.
Himself.
Thought thinking on itself.
Exactly. It is a closed loop of absolute self-reflection. He is thinking about his own thinking. Eternally. Uninterrupted.
It really creates this massive disconnect. You have this entity that is metaphysically perfect. No warts, no wrinkles, pure goodness. But it is practically impersonal. There is no grand plan for your life. There is no listening to prayers.
No, none of that.
Yeah.
Dr. Holmes points out that while Aristotle uses words like God and the good, and he implies a sort of moral perfection, this is functionally a logical necessity. It's there to make the physics equation balance. It explains why the stars move. It isn't really there to comfort you in times of trouble.
It's a God that passes the Turing test of logic but completely fails the test of compassion.
Well said.
But, you know, talking about logic, we've been describing what Aristotle thought. But the source material makes a really interesting shift here. It moves from his metaphysics directly into his organon.
Which is crucial. Because you can't really separate the two. I mean, how did Aristotle come up with all this? He didn't have a particle collider. He had language. He had logic.
Right. The organon, it sounds like a musical instrument, but it actually just translates to the instrument or the tool, right? Yeah.
Yes. It is the collection of his logical works. This is where Aristotle basically invents the rules of the game that Western philosophy played by for the next 2,000 years. If you've ever categorized something or used a syllogism, you're using Aristotle's tool set.
So let's dive into that tool set. Specifically, the categories. This is basically Aristotle organizing all of reality into buckets.
It is the ultimate filing system. He says any term you use signifies one of several categories. Substance, which is what something is. Quality, what it's like. Quantity, how much. Relation, place, time, and so on.
But the outline mentions something really specific here that I think is cool. The way he defines things using genus, species, and differentia. This is something we actually still use in biology today, isn't it?
It is, though he used it primarily for logic. The idea is to define something, you first find its genus, the larger group it belongs to. And then you find the differentia, the specific trait that makes it unique within that broader group.
So take humans. What are we?
Well, our genus is animal. We are living, breathing, moving things. But what separates us from cows or cats?
Yeah.
What is our differentia?
Aristotle would say reason, right?
Exactly. So the definition of the species human is rational animal. You take the broad group, add the specific difference, and boom, you have a solid definition.
Rational animal. I know some people who might test that definition on a Friday night, but I get the point.
Right.
But why does this matter? Why go to all this trouble to meticulously categorize words?
Because if you don't, you end up talking nonsense.
Yeah.
You end up making what is called a category mistake.
Yeah.
Aristotle was obsessed with clarity. If you start an argument using a word in the substance category, you absolutely cannot switch halfway through and use it in the quality category.
Dr. Holmes shares a specific joke, a syllogism that illustrates this perfectly. I want to read it, but I really want us to break down why it's wrong. Because when you hear it fast, it almost sounds like it makes sense.
Let's hear it.
Okay, here it is. Premise one. I love you, therefore I am a lover. Premise two. All the world loves a lover. Conclusion. You are all the world to me, therefore, you love me.
It sounds romantic, doesn't it? It's a classic play on words. But logically, it is a complete train wreck.
So walk me through the wreck. Where does the logic actually snap?
Look at the term all the world. In the second premise, all the world loves a lover. What does all the world refer to?
It refers to people. Everyone on Earth. It's a substance, a collection of humans.
Exactly. But look at the conclusion. You are all the world to me. Does that mean you are 8 billion people?
No. It means you are important. It's a value judgment.
Right. It's a quality or a relation signifying importance. So in the middle of the argument, the term all the world completely switched buckets. It went from substance, meaning people, to quality, meaning value.
That is the category mistake.
That is equivocation. And because the fundamental meaning changed, the logic falls apart completely. The conclusion that you love me doesn't follow at all.
It is basically a fancy academic way of saying don't play word games.
Yes.
But for Aristotle, this wasn't just about winning debates at dinner parties or correcting bad poetry. It was about science.
It was about truth, with a capital T. In the Posterior Analytics, he asks a really deep question. How do we actually know the starting points of our knowledge are true?
This is the epistemology part, the theory of knowledge.
Right. If you want to prove something scientifically, you use a syllogism. A implies B, B implies C, therefore A implies C. But where do you get A? How do you know that very first premise is actually true?
Plato, who was Aristotle's teacher, he had an answer for this, didn't he?
Plato's answer was innate ideas. He thought we were born already knowing the truth because our souls saw these perfect forms in a past life. We just have to remember them.
Which is very mystical. And I'm guessing Aristotle, being the guy who likes, you know, looking at starfish and dissecting plants, didn't really buy the past life theory.
Not for a single second. He completely rejects innate ideas. But, and this is key, he also rejects pure empiricism. Mm. He doesn't think you can know universal truth just by looking at stuff. Wait, really? I thought he was the observation guy, the guy who famously points down at the earth in that painting.
He is. But observation only gives you particulars. You see this white swan. You see that white swan over there. But your physical eyes can never see the universal rule that all swans are white. You can't see a universal concept.
So if we aren't born knowing it, and we can't just see it with our eyes, how do we know anything for sure?
That is the big cliffhanger Aristotle leaves us on in this section. But he does propose a solution. He believes we have a mental capacity to take in sense data, those particulars, and through a process of rigorous reasoning, we grasp the universal form. It is essentially the birth of the scientific method. Observation leading to induction, leading to universal principles.
It really is amazing to step back and look at it. He builds a god out of sheer logic, and then he builds the logic to check his own work.
He really provides the intellectual framework for the next two millennia of human thought.
So let's recap this whole journey. We started with the fixed stars spinning out at the very edge of the universe. To explain that motion without falling into an infinite regression, we found the unmoved mover.
A being of pure actuality. No potential. No change whatsoever.
A being that moves the universe, not by pushing it, but by being so incredibly perfect that the universe just falls in love with it.
A final cause.
And this being spends eternity doing literally the only thing worthy of it, which is thinking about its own thoughts, ignoring us completely.
While we, down here on Earth, use the tools of the organon categorizing species, avoiding equivocation, to try and understand it all.
You know, the source mentions a quote by Henry Veitch that really stuck with me. He said that Aristotle teaches us that man is not the measure of all things. God is.
It is a profoundly humbling perspective. The sophists of his time were all running around saying, man is the measure. We decide what is true. Aristotle steps in and says, no. There is an objective reality, a perfection out there, and we are just small parts of a massive cosmos striving toward it. It entirely displaces humanity from the center of importance.
And that actually leads to a tension that I want to leave you, the listener, with today. We have just spent all this time describing a theology that is, within its own system, logically bulletproof. The physics works, the logic works. Mm-hmm. But it results in a God that is emotionally hollow.
It does. It raises a really profound question about the very nature of perfection. We usually think of compassion, empathy, and caring as the absolute highest virtues. We think a perfect being would naturally be infinitely loving.
But for Aristotle, caring implies a need. If I care about you, your sadness makes me sad. That is a change. That is a vulnerability. So here is the question for you to mull over. Is caring actually a weakness, or is Aristotle's definition of perfection simply too cold?
It forces you to choose. Do you want a God who is metaphysically unbreakable, or a God who is relationally available? It is very, very hard to have both.
Is it better to be a perfect narcissist or a vulnerable lover? Something to think about next time you look up at the stars and wonder if they're looking back. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
A deep dive indeed.
We'll see you next time.